Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the War Report. Of all the shows that we've done here on the War Report, probably well over 200 broadcasts, if you've been with us from the beginning or near the beginning, you will recognize what I'm about to say, that this show and all the shows that I do on, specifically on the issue of privatization, when I say the privatization of everything and everyone, humanity and the planet, you will know that is the message that we've been trying to get over here on the War Report for the last 3.5 years. Of all the shows and of all the issues and all the topics and all the guests and what have you that has been on the show, none is more dear to my heart than the issue of privatization, because it's the one that scares the hell out of me. And remember, early in our show, I said, when I say privatization, I want you to think immediately of ownership and control. The Machiavellian agenda's true end game is the ownership and control of everyone and everything. That's the humanity, that's the planet that I mentioned. So, today's show is basically driving at the heart of what the War Report is all about. And again, and I always say this because I'm not sure, I'll take that back, I'm pretty sure, many people who listen to the War Report may not get our promotion that we try and put out every Thursday night, no later than sometime Friday, where we tell you what the show is going to be about 48 hours from when you get it, and give you some information, background, and sometimes we even give you links that you can go to and get some early perspective on what the issue is all about. And if whenever we do the privatization, I always come with the idea of, at the end of the day, people, it is privatization that we should all be aware and very, very afraid that if the corporate state and its allies, the financial, the private, the philanthropic capitalists, you name it, get their way, we will truly be a privatized humanity and a privatized planet. Today's show could easily be two more shows, but I'm going to try to not extend it beyond today because there's some things I want to get into in the month of August. But I can't help but go back a little bit and deal with something that we talk about here quite often, and that is some of the movies and books that write on as it relates to this notion of privatization and this notion of control of humanity and the planet by a handful of people. And of course, you know, my favorite of all time is the book and then the movie 1984. And we've done several shows on The Matrix. These two movies, books, were incredible. They're science fiction. And one thing, if you know your genres as it relates to movies and to literature, science fiction, good science fiction, really is giving its readers a glimpse of the present reality. And if you study the movie or the book, you can say this is analogous. What's in the movie, the book, analogous to what's happening in reality. Or it's a showing you what the future may be in reality. I can't say it any more plain than what I just said. Good fiction, movies, television, series, literature, if you really get into it, and like a 1984 and like a Matrix, they were telling you these are the problems of today in reality, people. And if you don't wake up to it, this is what your future may look like. Two films came out in the last 2 weeks, and to me, they were right on with where we are today in the war on public education. One is The War for the Planet of the Apes, the reboot. Those of you who maybe, I won't say my age because most people are not, aren't, but back in the 70s, maybe 60s, when the first Planet of the Apes movie came out, and then there were four or five sequels. But that first movie, we see a crew of humans from Earth, specifically from the U.S. They're in a spaceship. Something happens. They give them some type of notion of warp, and it's hundreds of years in the future when the ship crash lands and only one person seems to have survived, Charlton Heston. And he wanders, he's on this planet, lands on the beach and there's the ocean and then there's the land. And so he wanders and he gets caught by apes on horseback. And apes can speak. He can't. He has a throat injury. He can't speak. And so they capture him and they take him to their city. And you see that the city is an organized city. And the apes are running, walking around in clothes and on and on and on. And he's put in like a jail that's also a museum where he discovers other members of his crew are in these mummified state, they're dead, and he can understand the apes talking English, but he can't speak at that point. And point of the show was that something has happened. Apes have the human capacity, which we always have said would separate us from all the animals, was our ability to speak or communication. Not realizing that dolphins had this elaborate communication and other animals, but of course, we being humans, we were at the top of the food chain. We were saying that we had the sole capacity to do this. But anyway, as the movie progresses, he finally gets his voice back, and the apes are baffled, and blah, blah, blah. And there are issues, conflict, da, da, da. Eventually, at the end, a few apes decide to set him free. And he gets a horse, and he's riding back on the beach. And all of a sudden, he stops, and he falls to the ground, and, "You bastards, you did it. You finally did it." And he's looking at the Statue of Liberty that has floated up on the beach, all battered and tattered. And what that movie was about then was the possibility of nuclear war and what could be the outcome both for humans and for the planet. That started the series off. Then there were several other, like I think, 4 or 5 sequels, because they made money. They just kept making them until they stopped. Then, so many years later, there was a reboot. And we had the Planet of the Apes, 4 years ago. They were making every 2 years or so. And just last month, the third one in the reboot came out. And, of course, I wanted to see it the first night it came out, because I'm a big fan of it. And I want to sort of give away my point here at this point, but the first reboot and the second reboot, there was this conflict between humans and the apes. And as we progress to the one that just came out, what we see here is that the apes have been holding their own, kicking butt in terms of all efforts to get rid of them, basically, to finish them off. And they are surviving. And then there's an invasion again of humans coming to finish them off. And there's the big battles and what have you. To me, watching this, I'm looking at it and I'm saying several things. But one of the things that I'm saying is this is very good analogy to the war on public education and the people who have been trying to finish us off, us being the teachers, the students, the communities, public education itself as a public good, and the various waves of attempts to finish us off. And the apes, to me, represented what this particular show is about, the resistance. Think about what I just said. These apes, who are the humanoids to a considerable extent, is putting up a very strong resistance to both the invasion of what has become their country, and some would say their planet, and it's a resistance that they have ebbed and flowed with them having success, having tremendous losses, but then surviving, and then more success, more losses, the ebb and flow of this. But the key to me has been resistance. They did not go away peacefully in the night. Instead, they resisted. Among the apes, there were those who, there were factions. Some wanted to destroy humans. Others wanted to live peacefully with humans. They fought among themselves. Then there was, in the new movie, there were those apes who joined the humans who were seeking to destroy the apes. and unknown to them was going to destroy them, the people who, the apes that were helping them, once they finished off the apes that they're battling with. And so I kept looking at this and I'm going, this is one of the best contemporary examples that I know of as it relates to resistance. And I made up my mind sometime a couple of weeks ago that I had to bring this movie to everyone's attention, if you haven't seen it or and you know about it, and why I thought it was so right on at this time for what we're going through in public education. And to me, there's also other analogies there. The struggle, 400-year struggle of black survival in this country, and the resistance movement that has been part and parcel of the black experience here. And I could go on with other analogies, but that was really something. The other movie that I mentioned was Dunkirk. I don't know about you in terms of your knowledge of history, World War II, Dunkirk, Hitler starts his sweep across Europe. He's rolling across all the small countries, some of them without resistance. Within hours, he conquers countries, the smaller countries. And then France, I think Belgium and England are putting up resistance. The English, with their arrogance, commit colossal mismanagement of their participation in the war up to that point. And if you know the history, you know what I'm talking about. But quickly, they send an invasion force to across the channel to get on European soil. They're joining the French and the Belgium and other countries. And the Germans are kicking their, you know what, left and right. Germans are pushing them back to the beach town of Dunkirk, where the Germans have almost 600,000 English, Belgium, French troops encircled, and they're going to be annihilated. And if that takes place, England is going to fall. And it's just a matter of either hours or days, maybe a few weeks, because the bulk of their army is gone, and there's nothing stopping the Germans from invading by sea and controlling the air. So you got the English troops there on the beach, and what happens is this, quote, people call miracle. The big ships, battleships, can't get to the beach because it's a shallow depth, and the ships that can get to are not battleship warships per se. Bottom line is, the English soldiers and the rest are in deep shit. And the Germans are going to finish them off. The high command, the politician, have truly, truly screwed up. And they're going to end up, some are calling for surrender to Hitler. Many are saying in the parliament have to surrender, because if not, we're going to be totally decimated. And Churchill comes to the prime ministership, and he says no. Bottom line is, they got the citizens who own boats by the hundreds, by the thousands, to brave the, I don't know, 18, 20 miles, half an hour it took to get from the coast of England to the coast of either France or is it Belgium, to try and rescue as many of the troops that are trapped on the beach as possible. And they do. They rescue over 300,000 English troops, and they rescue a lot of the Belgium and the French troops, get them back to England. And you know the rest. the United States eventually joins the war, and they triumph. But what you don't know, and this is what really, really had me drawn into the movie, because I know the history, was the colossal failure of leadership in England. I mean, colossal. And yes, that was analogous to what I see happening here in the United States again in our war. And I said this a million times, and if I'm around long enough, I'll say it a million times. Our leadership, colossal, colossal failure. And had that same dynamic that the leadership and those who wanted to capitulate, those who wanted to cooperate, and the very few, if there were any, that wanted to wage a mighty resistance. And I'm looking at this movie. And again, I know this stuff backwards and forward. Remember, I'm the war junkie. I love the war movies. I was born during World War II, and I've studied war and seen the movies, the TV series, and read the books, and I know the big-time generals and the dumb generals, all of this stuff. But I'm sitting back, and I'm saying, and watch this movie. They're not showing the colossal stupidity, the colossal ignorance, the colossal everything of the leadership that got them into that spot. They were showing the heroics of the people, the common people, joining the resistance with their boats, risking their lives to go over to rescue as many of the soldiers as possible so that the war could go on. And so I'm watching these two movies and I'm saying, this is what resistance is all about. And then I kept saying to myself, and you guys, if you get our promotion, you know, at the very bottom of the promotion, we say, resistance matters. Resistance is not futile. Resistance is the highest form of expression of democracy. Resistance is survival. Take those four as separate dots. And when you add them together, I'm asking the question, you know, do you see what I see? Do you hear what I hear? And the question that was also stated in our promotion, can resistance end the privatization of everyone and everything? And if you been here for the last 2 weeks and back now, we've had a lot of dots that we've put up and we've discussed, and I've asked you each week, do you see what I see? What do you see in these dots? Can you connect them? And if you do, what are the dots telling you once you connect them? And that's part of, do you hear what I hear? I have no idea whether or not any of you have taken the time to really get involved in this exercise. I hope there were some of you, and I would love that it was most of you. Because this is so crucial to where we are. Remember, resistance is survival. If Churchill and that small faction that says, no, we're going to fight on. Remember that famous speech of Churchill? We'll fight on the ocean. We'll fight in the sky. We'll fight on the beaches, and we'll fight on the streets. We'll fight house to house. We will never surrender. That made him probably one of the most important people to be in history for the next, I don't know, many years. And he was saying resistance. And everything that we've been talking about here on the War Report has been urging everyone to get involved in the resistance at whatever level, whichever way you can, but we need you. And when I was out on my road trip, and I've mentioned all of this before, the number of people who wanted to be part of the resistance, but was so fearful that they couldn't and wouldn't be. And then there are the number of people who don't have a clue that this is a war and what it's all about and what losing the war really, really means. And then there is a much larger group who, in my view, don't have a clue that this war on public education is just one theater of a bigger war. You've heard me say that too, time and time again. And that it's not just happening here in the U.S. This is a global war. Not just on public education, but on a much broader table of goodies that are up for being privatized. And when you connect all of those dots, maybe you begin to see what I'm saying. The privatization of everyone and everything. And that is the end game of the Machiavellian agenda. Is to have the 1% truly control the 99%, the 7 billion plus people on the planet for 1,000 years. That's the new Reich you always hear me talk about. And you take it back to Hitler, you take it back to the Romans. And the Romans having had an empire that lasted 1,000 years. And so there are all these dots out here. And my question still is the same. Can resistance end the privatization of everyone and everything? I would love to hear from you, but I know that's not going to happen, so I'll go further. If you ask me that today, I would say, in America, no way. Because we have no resistance. I can't even call what we have a resistance. It'll be an insult to the millions of people over the years, the centuries, who've actually mounted a resistance to say what's going on in America is, quote, a resistance. Again, these are my views. You don't have to agree with them. You can disagree with them. Whatever. This is what I see. This is what I hear. And this is what I've been saying for 3.5 years. This is what has made me persona non grata in many quarters. And I maybe will deal with that later on to tell you that's a true statement. I'm not lying. I'm not exaggerated. I am persona non grata in a lot of places. And some of those places have made a good effort to bring payback my way. And you know that old saying that, you know, two sayings. One, recognize payback when you see it. And two, payback is a bitch. Believe me, some of their efforts to bring payback my way have been a real bitch. I'm here to prove that. But anyway, that's another story, another show. So, why do I say that, in my view, resistance here in America can't end privatization? Because it's an enemy. But then I'm going to say something that may seem to others a total contradiction. On a global scale, global resistance, it's happening. And it's working. Resistance is turning the tables resistance is pushing back. There are countries and cities around the globe that are actually turning back privatization. Before I finish that sentence, I've been studying privatization for a long time, long before the War Report. I must have 5, maybe 6 different folders that have hundreds of articles and books that I've read, collected over the last maybe 10 years or so. And I really, really didn't think I would see the day when I would be optimistic that privatization could be halted and then pushed back, defeated, turned around. I was very pessimistic, mainly because, again, I'm here in America and I'm watching the privatizers steamroll all over us in every area that they can. And just like the Germans in World War II, when they went into some of the countries in Europe and didn't fire a single shot, roll their tanks, march their men without any resistance, the length and breadth of the country. And in some countries, people were on the streets waving German flags, welcoming them to the occupation of their country and annexing their country and making it part of the new Reich, the German Empire. This is what I see in America. City, state, county government, federal government, allied with the corporations, the philanthropic groups, the finance community, to never be where they are without government assistance and acquiescence. Never. Remember when I talked about neoliberalism, that one of the tenets of neoliberalism was that the government was to use its authority, then its force, if necessary, to bring about conditions that were the most favorable and conducive to the neoliberal movement to achieve its immediate and ultimate goals. And the government has done that. Lock, stock, and barrel, Supreme Court, the presidency, both houses of Congress, governors, both chambers of state government, mayors, counties, have all been puppeteers almost. Well, not puppeteers, puppets, and allowing the privatization march to spread across the United States, and then the United States exporting it wherever they could, too. So, no, I have not been optimistic. Again, I consider myself not a pessimist, but a realist, and I'm not what I see, what I hear, saying that we're screwed. And then, but when I pull back and look at the big picture, oh, man, it can happen. And it can happen in your lifetime. Now, let me give you the evidence here. Today is Sunday. I think it was Friday. A report I got, 280-65-page report. It's a big one, folks. And it broke down Global Resistance. And that was basically the title, was Global Resistance, Reclaiming Public Services. And public services, let me make sure what we're talking about here. The 1% in the corporate elite, they want, in essence, our tax dollars. Government collects taxes, and I said government, I'm thinking all levels of government, collect taxes, in particular the federal government, then puts us billions of dollars into defense. And it's the corporations that they sign contracts with in the tens of billions of dollars that mounts up to that, they say, 500, 600 billion. We have no idea how much they're actually spending. And it's not the 500 to 600 billion that you're talking about, folks. That, I truly believe, I'm not the only one. Then, those same people, they wanted our health care, health services. They wanted to privatize that. You know what I'm talking about because you've experienced the privatization of the health care sector and the government participation in it. And you know, just 2 days ago, there was a showdown in the Senate where three Republicans said, no, we don't want to see the end of Obamacare, and there's no replacement. And you know, that battle's been going on for, what, 7-8 years. Public education, and I said this, from pre-K to PhDs, were from somewhere around $1.2 to $1.5 trillion a year. Globally, $7 trillion. They, being the privateers, they want that $7 trillion. And they've gone after it globally. And water, the privatization of water. And I've had a show or two on this, where there are five major corporations who are racing against each other to buy up. And I said, buy up, meaning owning water source globally, so that between them, they will control 70, 80, 90% of the Earth fresh water supply. Not only will control it, they'll own it. And remember that famous statement from the chairman of Nestle? Nestle is it Switzerland? Headquartered in Switzerland? That hit YouTube and went viral and, you know, scared the hell out of people. And he said that human beings have no legal, moral right to water? Listen to what I just said. One of the most basic elements sustaining life, we have no rights to it as a common good. In fact, he goes on to say that in those instances where the public has owned control of the water supply, they screwed it up. And it's going to be the corporations who are going to come in and unscrew it. And hence, they have the right to do it and then to parcel water out to us at whatever cost, unfeather their ability to do this. That's a legal term. And that's just one incident. And then the climate change. The people who are polluting the air, the water, and who threatening all of humanity and the planet, they're fighting like tooth and nails to keep us, the people who are suffering, from being able to stop them. And I'm pretty sure I've mentioned here in Nevada, where the solar industry was really taking off. People, Nevada, if you know Nevada, most days you see the sun. And in spring, summer, fall, you see a lot of the sun that is hot as hell there. People were jumping on the solar panels like crazy. It was threatening the grid, and the people who make money from the energy sector got to the legislature, and they started coming up with laws saying they were going to do basically away with your right to have solar panels on your house. They did come up with a law that cracks me up, saying that you couldn't collect snow that's on your house, on your property, and convert it to a fresh water source. And I've talked about this, so you know, those who have been around you, you're not hearing this for the first time. And then there were several other states where if you had a water stream coming through your property, you didn't own it all of a sudden. And if you tried to harness that water supply, it was against the law. I think it was a guy in Oregon, went to jail, may still be in jail, because he said, to hell with that. My land, my water rights, and I can use it the way I want. But the Northwest, because I'm in the Northeast now, the Northwest and other places, the corporate state is saying that if snow falls on your property, you can't convert it to water. If you do, that's a crime now. This is privatization. And in our country, we know privatization of roads, highways. Now, the privatization of schools. Privatization of governments. Whole governments, city governments are turning themselves over to contract with corporations to replace the mayor and the city manager and the city council and the governance. And I can go on in the courts and on and on and on. Oh, no. You know about this. But I was so thrilled when I got this report and said it's a 236-page report. And it's how cities and citizens are turning back privatization. And just give you some of the highlights from this report. And I'm going to run out of time. You know, I've got page and page of notes, and I'm not even through my first page. But anyway, highlight. They call it remunicipalization of public service worldwide. And one of the bottom lines is that there are 835 places worldwide that are pushing back against privatization. More than 1,600 cities around the world are engaging in action to bring back public services under public control. That is a mouthful. Sure, there are thousands and thousands of cities and municipalities around the world. But the fact that we do have, according to this report, 1,600 that are actively doing this is amazing to me. And of this 1,600, we have a paltry 67 in the U.S. and 19 in Canada. I'm going to say that again. Out of the 1,600, 67 in the U.S., 19 in Canada. Remember from the shows on neoliberalism. I said that Chile, then England, were, I'm positive that I have it in that order and that I'm right, that they were like the first countries to jump on this neoliberalism ban. Margaret Thatcher, when she became the first woman prime minister of Britain, and then Augusto Pinochet, when he became the dictator of Chile after the U.S. and our military, our CIA, helped bring about a violent coup, killing the president of the country at that time, Allende. And they immediately, after that, Chile started massive privatization. They had gotten that idea and practice from University of Chicago under Milton Friedman. Chile has sent, its upper class has sent a group of men that's known as the Chicago Boys to University of Chicago to study privatization under the gist of the Nobel Prize winner, Milton Friedman. They come back to Chile, and when the coup is over, they help implement privatization of the entire country, privatizing all the industries, water, schools, you name it. Then Margaret Thatcher, she follows suit, and eventually Ronald Reagan is elected. He starts the privatization when he fired the air traffic controllers, PEPCO, breaking the unions and sending a message to the unions all across the U.S. Now, here's what you probably don't know, and that is in what they call the re-municipalization, there are 10 countries, well, 10 cities, multiple countries, that are really kind of push the envelope in terms of basically taking back their public service and putting back in the hands of the public from the corporations. And when you hear this list, how about Nigeria? How about Brazil, Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, Lagos, the capital of Nigeria, Barcelona, Spain. There's Teresa, I can't pronounce this right, folks, but there are three places in Spain that are pushing back. India, of all places. Indonesia. And in that 10 cities that are struggling to push back against privatization, only two in the U.S., in the state, one in the state of Montana and one in California, Apple Valley. I say struggling, they're working to reclaim public control over water, wastewater, major privatization, working against major privatization of water. This has been perhaps one of the areas where the public pushback has really came to the forefront. And I've talked about that, too, in terms of the privatization of water, the most essential element we need to sustain life. Sectors, areas of which the re-municipalization has occurred the most. And this is a total effort worldwide by countries. Water leads the push. 267 countries in total are re-municipalization of water, with France leading the way with 106 different municipalities pushing back, maybe 100, as many as 166. U.S., only 63. wastewater control. Germany leads the way. There's 31 countries. Germany leads the way with 13 of her cities. Energy, 311 countries. Germany leads the way here with 264. The U.S., 6. Britain, or U.K., 5. Here's one that's of interest to us. Education. 11 countries are pushing back. Germany leads the way, 5 of her cities. UK, 3. Local government. In other words, people taking back their local government. That's taking place in 140 countries. Healthcare and social work services. 37 countries are pushing back, with Norway leading the way with 16, Sweden 17. In the area, as I said before, education, worldwide is lagging. Now, I want to go more into that, but I can see that, you know, education, I mean, energy, transportation, water, getting back your local government, health and human services, I can see where those are outshining the effort to take back the education. Don't like it, but I can see it. Okay. Then there's this, again, that word that I'm having trouble with, manipulation, but it's mutual. You know what I'm talking about, cities, government. 692 cities, region have reversed privatization. Cities and regions and cooperatives, they have acted to reverse privatization. Citizens, workers-led cooperatives have worked to push back or reverse privatization. You don't see that a number for the U.S. We have 143 municipalities worldwide that are working to create new local control public services in the areas of energy, waste management, social services, water, local government, and education. Also, places where they have actually deprivatized from when they were privatized. The decision to, and how did this come about, this deprivatization? It came about through decisions of the people to reclaim their municipality. It came by, that was 32 locations. 445 came about because those companies that had contracts with the city to provide services, their contracts expired and they were not renewed. 136 countries had, they actually terminated those corporations who had contracts with them to privatize the roads, water supply to the homes, electricity. Boom. They just said, hell no, we're done with this. 34 countries. They got together and they, you know, people within the countries got together and they bought back to some extent their rights to privatize their, I mean, to public ownership of their public services. Then you have 12 instances where private operated corporation just withdrew. They found out that, hey, they could not make money on the basis of the contract that they entered into. Of this total where they deprivatized, it was at the level of The municipal level, 493 municipalities. Nationally, or internationally, I should say internationally, 234. Regionally, 96. Privatization and deprivatization. Deprivatization has gotten its start 2010 to 2012, with the peak year 2016, last year, when this deprivatization has started. And as I said, education has lagged, trying to deprivatize energy, transportation, healthcare, water, waterways, local control. I'm going to end up with a question, actually it's a statement. If other countries and cities are reclaiming public service, why aren't we, the U.S., the United States, counties, cities, citizens, why aren't we leading or participating, let alone leading in the deprivatization? Time is up. Thanks, folks. As I said, I could go on with this forever, but maybe I'll do it again later. Thank you. Have a good rest of your Sunday.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.